Welcome. We're glad you chose to be with us this afternoon. The forum, even though that's pretty nice out there, just in case you didn't notice. Yeah, our program today is with Dr. Yonker talking about archaeology and the biblical accuracy, a look at minimalist, maximalist, and Adventist views. So we'll follow our usual format with a presentation and then a time for discussion afterwards. Gary Gray will have the wireless mic, and you can chip in with your comments, compliments, and questions. As we begin our time today, Laren Kurtz is going to offer a word of prayer for us.
Gracious Father in heaven, we thank you so much for the opportunity that we have to come and look at this subject this afternoon. We pray that your Holy Spirit will be here as we look at the issues and look at the questions. There are many different ways in which your word is regarded and interpreted. Individuals who do so are sincere, but their viewpoints are very different. We pray, Lord, that as we look at the various different viewpoints today, that you will help us to see things from various points of view so we'll better be able to understand where they are coming from and how these different viewpoints may also instruct us. We ask for your blessing now in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Some years ago, a pastor in Pennsylvania, Griswold Williams, proposed a sort of covenant for his church, and I'd just like to share it with you. It's brief. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve human need, to the end that all souls shall grow into harmony with the divine. Thus do we covenant with each other and with God. Oh, I guess if you want to have a creed, why, that's probably not bad. Some words about our upcoming forum programs. Our next program is January 28 of next year. It will feature Dr. James Londis, who is retired from many positions. His last one, I believe, was as Director of Ethics and Corporate Integrity at Kettering Medical Center, but he's been a college president, a professor, a pastor, and author, and so on. So I think you'll enjoy his presentation. Then in February, Dr. John Jones from La Sierra University. He teaches New Testament studies and world religions. He's going to be with us, and he's a very articulate speaker. On March 10, Dr. Jerome Thayer from our School of Education will be talking about the cognitive genesis study, which examined the impact of Adventist education on students in the K through 12 range. You've probably all heard about value genesis. This is looking more at the academic impact of Adventist schools. So again, bear that in mind, and we'll have more details for you as we get closer. And speaking of future meetings, if you would like to be notified by email and you're not being, there are some sign-up sheets in the back, where you can give us your name and emails, and we can add you to the mailing list. Again, we thank the people who work down front here, Jim Harris, and the people behind the scenes, and Debbie Robertson and Terry Calkins with the publicity, and they all help to make these things happen. And I'd also like to thank those of you who have contributed financially to the forum. We look forward to using those resources to bring programs that wouldn't be available to us otherwise. And would just say, as you're thinking about your year-end charitable contributions, we invite you to keep the chapter in mind, particularly if you have any unused private jets or luxury automobiles or second homes on the Riviera that you're wanting to donate to charity. Why, there are some envelopes in the back you can pick up. Our speaker today, I think most of us are acquainted with in one way or another, Dr. Randy Yonker. He's been at Andrews here for a long time now. He's professor of Old Testament and Biblical Archaeology. He's also director of the Institute of Archaeology here at Andrews. He graduated from Pacific Union College, holds graduate degrees from the University of Arizona. Has a background in both biology and in archaeology. Probably read some of the articles that he's written. He lectures widely on archaeology and issues in science and the Bible and history. He teaches with Dr. Baldwin a course in the seminary called Issues and Origins. And he has been involved for, the 90s or 80s, he started getting... 1980, over in the Middle East with the excavation projects that Andrews has been involved with. So today he's going to be talking about archaeology and the biblical accuracy, a look at minimalist, maximalist, and Adventist views. And so the time is yours, and we'll look forward to some dialogue afterwards.
It's nice to be here. This is actually very familiar turf because John and Baldwin and I have been teaching our Issues and Origins class in this very room. So, and actually, I have to say that after 26 years of teaching that class, John is retiring. And so we only have, I think, one more lecture. And then this tradition of 26 years will come to an end right after the Thanksgiving break. I head off. There actually will be a class, I think, this Tuesday, but I will miss that because of heading out to San Francisco for some annual meetings on archaeology, actually. We have a large contingent that goes out every year from Andrews University and some of our sister Adventist institutions because of the heavy involvement of Adventists in the area of archaeology. So I'll miss the next class, then I'll come back after Thanksgiving break, and John and I will do our very last class, and 26 years will come to an end. So we'll have to see what will happen in the future. I think our colleague Martin Hanna will pick up the mantle and carry on somehow. Well, when I was invited to speak, I was glad not to speak on creation, actually. I deal with that a lot because of my background in Old Testament and biology, but I really am trained as an archaeologist, and I went into that area on purpose, and I prefer to talk about that because that's where most of my training is. So I was happy that they asked me to speak a little bit on archaeology. They wanted something provocative. That wasn't the exact word, but I sensed they wanted something that would be interesting. And so I thought I would share with you. This is sort of descriptive, not necessarily, judgmental, although I have my opinions, which will come out clearly enough as we move along. And I thought I would share with you an issue that's been growing over the last couple of decades, continues to grow in the area of biblical archaeology, or how some people like to call it, Syro-Palestinian archaeology. And what's going on? It's a very interesting debate. It's getting very heated. And then also how Adventists have been involved. I'm not sure how much I'll get into various Adventist views. Maybe that can come out more into the discussion section. We certainly have, as a group, been very much involved in this debate in different ways. And you'll see that, particularly my own involvement. It's easier for me to talk about that. I don't necessarily want to step on the toes or steal the thunder from my colleagues who are doing their own thing. But I certainly know that Dr. Stan LaBianca is a fellow archaeologist here on campus, and we have Connie Gain and Ajelko Greger and others, plus a large number of graduate students who are all involved in this area. And I'm very proud of what they are doing, the contributions they're making to the discipline, and maybe we'll be able to talk about that a little bit later on as well. Well, one of the reasons, there's many reasons why we do archaeology as Seventh-day Adventists and certainly here at Andrews University. One of the questions, not the only question, but probably one of the major historical motivating questions was this one. This is the cover story a few years ago that came out in U.S. News World Report. I'm not even sure that's hard copy anymore. Most of these magazines are disappearing or becoming something that exists only in cyberspace. But anyway, I was intrigued by this because it came out right after and in response to a program that was aired on PBS about archaeology in the Bible. And one of my, among the many people being interviewed, my major professor, William Deaver, who's a leading Syro-Palestinian archaeologist, taught for years at the University of Arizona where I did my graduate work. He was one of the key people they had involved in the interview. So I was intrigued by this. I bought the magazine, and right on the cover, they asked the question, is the Bible true? That's a question of great interest still in this country. Even in our postmodern period where such questions are not supposed to be asked, I find that there's still a lot of curiosity. Is the Bible true? And if it is true, what does that mean? And this was sort of the background to this particular issue. Most of you are aware that within Old Testament, I'm actually housed in the Old Testament department in the seminary, even though I live in my own little building out there next to Apple Valley, where the Institute of Archaeology is located. And by the way, I should make a little plug. If you haven't been there yet, you should come by some day during normal working hours, 9 to 5, or on Sabbath afternoons. We have a neat little museum over there, the Horn Archaeological Museum, and you might like to come in and see some of our treasures. We have over 8,500 treasures. It's not true that we have the Ark of the Covenant down in the basement. Some people, because of our not admitting that, have called us the Little Horn Museum, but that's not really fair, but that's how some people feel. Nevertheless, we are interested in the question of the historicity of the Bible. That's one reason for going into archaeology. As my own professor, William Deaver, said, archaeology provides, and think about this, it provides the only way to get new information about the Bible. You mean the Bible has a text, is what it is. And over the last couple thousand years, there have been thousands upon thousands upon thousands of scholars from different belief systems, Jewish, Christian, and otherwise, who have written lots of books about the Bible. And the James White Library, particularly the seminary section right next to us, is full literally of hundreds of thousands. I'm not sure how many volumes there are. Sure, certainly there's tens of thousands on all sorts of every topic in theology, in Old Testament, even in archaeology. We have a very nice archaeological collection. And people have been very fascinated about the question of whether the Bible is historically true or not, and they write whole books off of that particular perspective of whether it is or isn't and what the implications might be. One of the leading individuals who started casting doubt upon the historical veracity of the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, was Wilhelm de Wet. We usually think of Wellhausen, but before Wellhausen, there were a number of scholars, including de Wet, who to me was probably one of the most influential in the 19th century. He was one who started in 1800, shortly after 1800, questioning the claim that Moses wrote the Pentateuch, whether Moses even wrote any of the Old Testament, you know, of those five books, whether he existed was something that de Wet started to wonder about. He eventually moved into the Old Testament books, including Daniel, beyond the Pentateuch, beyond the Mosaic books. He eventually came to discount the historicity of most of the Old Testament. So he was one of the first to systematically look at the Old Testament and question whether there was much of historical value in there. He would have an influence, I think I left out the next picture, on Wellhausen, who's more famous for his work in the 1880s when he came out with his famous Prolegomenon on the Old Testament. And he questioned seriously whether there was much of historical value in the Old Testament at all. And that made a major influence on the development of the discipline of archaeology. And by the way, people may not realize this, but archaeology primarily started as a pursuit to understand the context of the Bible. There are many secular departments of archaeology around the world today, University of Chicago, you go almost any of the major universities, they have departments of archaeology. But the early archaeologists were actually motivated by and started their work in the Holy Land. They were interested and curious about those questions. Around the 1920s, historical criticism had made such a major impact on Old Testament studies that it motivated William Albright to look into these issues. He is known as the Dean of American Biblical Archaeology. Our own Siegfried Horn studied with Albright. There's a direct connection with the famous William Albright, and our own Leona Running actually worked with Albright, was a graduate assistant for him, and helped write with David Noel Freeman a biography of William Albright. Albright is thought to have been a genius. He seemed to have such a mastery of all these topics related to Old Testament studies including linguistics, and he pioneered the field of biblical archaeology from an American perspective. One of my favorite stories about him is how he was invited to come to Israel early in his career. He'd made such a name for himself as a scholar that the Israelis invited him to come and lecture in Israel. And they were expecting, of course, this American professor to speak in English. They spoke Hebrew, of course, which was a resurrected language, resurrected by the Zionists. And of course, by the 1920s and 30s, all the Israelis spoke Hebrew fluently. It was a modern version of Hebrew, not quite identical to biblical Hebrew. But they were expecting Albright to speak English. He shows up in the lecture hall, and he starts speaking to them in Hebrew. And they were absolutely floored. He had never been to Jerusalem and taken an opon and learned how to speak Hebrew. Where in the world did he learn Hebrew? How could he speak it? He had learned it from reading the Bible in Hebrew. And actually, what he was speaking was biblical Hebrew, which would be somewhat akin to someone coming here to lecture to you. Maybe they would be French, but they spoke to you in English, but they had studied Shakespearean English. And so you could kind of understand them, and you would be quite impressed and amazed, but it wasn't quite the English you'd be used to speaking or hearing. And so these Israeli scholars were rather floored that this American professor could speak to them fluently. Usually, scholarly languages like that, dead languages, are something you read and talk about. You don't speak. He could speak it. And that was quite an impressive feat. And that just added to his stature as a genius. He headed up the American school that tried to go after the German criticism of the Old Testament. He argued that there actually is, through archaeology, a way to get at the contemporary world of the Bible. That was a point I started to make a few minutes ago and I digress from. As Deaver said, the only news source for information about the Bible is archaeology. The text is what it is. Lots of people write about it, but they're just really writing about the same text. But when you dig into the ground, you go down into the levels of the time periods when these biblical people actually lived, you have the possibility of digging up contemporary data, new data from the time of David or from the time of Abraham or from the time of King Hezekiah. It might be just material remains, buildings and things that they ate and the dishes and pots and so forth. It could be inscriptions, though. And sometimes those inscriptions might actually talk about biblical places and events. And they do sometimes, not as much as we would like, but such discoveries are made. And so this is why Albright invested so much in this. He felt that archaeology could be used to disprove the historical critical attitudes, the skepticism about the Old Testament. So he started an American tradition. His student was G. Ernest Wright, who ended up becoming the professor of Old Testament theology and archaeology at Harvard University. And a number of our scholars in the Adventism study there, besides the owner Running and Larry Garrity, Larry Herr got his PhD from Harvard. They were all part of the Wright tradition, if you will. And then, of course, there was John Bright, who was a Old Testament historian. So it was the Albright, Wright, and Bright school. You have to rhyme with right to be part of this school. It's not left, it's not wrong, it's right. In fact, when my own Professor Deaver was deviating a bit from the Albright, Wright, Bright tradition, Wright took him down like a father to his son, and he said to Deaver, "Bill, you need to get right with Albright." And Bill never forgot that. Today, these folks are called maximalists because they believe that there's a maximum amount of historically reliable information in the Old Testament. Albright was not so naive as to think that everything in the Bible as we have it is exactly the way it was. At least that was not his attitude. But he felt that the basic historical timeline, the basic historical events that are described in the Old Testament really did happen. And the more he would dig into the ground, the more he believed that he was finding evidence that verified the Old Testament story. And so this became known as the American School of Biblical Archaeology. The Bible was basically accurate. Here's a picture of his student, G. Ernest Wright, who was professor at Harvard for many years. I have pictures of him with Larry Garrity and some of our Adventists. G. Ernest Wright was very interested in the Adventist project that started at Tel Hesban with Siegfried Horn in 1967, delayed actually a year because of the 67 war, and really got going in 68. But Wright was personally interested in that. Siegfried actually worked under Wright at Shechem prior to this. That's where Siegfried cut his teeth and got his experience, was under G. Ernest Wright at Shechem in what's now known as Nablus in Palestine. I found out something very interesting, that my own major professor's first dig, archaeological dig, William Deaver's first dig, was at Shechem. He actually took me there a few years ago and said, pointed to a hole in the ground, said, "This was the very first hole I ever dug as an archaeologist." And he says, "My supervisor was a guy named Siegfried Horn." I thought, wow, it's kind of funny how all these things interweave. And he says, I have no idea what I dug, but that's my hole. You know, later on he could figure it out, but at the time he was just digging dirt, moving rocks, and picking up potsherds. So G. Ernest Wright was a very key influence. He started the digs at Shechem and later at Gezer, where I would end up digging with Bill Deaver years later. Siegfried Horn and Bill Shea also dug at Gezer with G. Ernest Wright. So we've had a lot of Adventist interaction with the Albrightian school. G. Ernest Wright wrote a book that's quite important, might be of interest to the folks here in view of some of the discussions you've been having in John Walton and his work on Genesis recently. This book was published in 1952. You can see a little picture of it in the right-hand corner. It's entitled The God Who Acts. And what G. Ernest Wright's basic premise is that the Old Testament Hebrews, and this is based somewhat on his awareness of ancient Near Eastern culture, languages, literature, and his familiarity with the Old Testament itself beyond the ancient Near East and the archaeological record, he said that the Hebrews, at their core, were interested in historical reality. This is what shaped their whole self-understanding as a people and formulated their liturgy. And so this is what this book basically is nailing down. History is absolutely critical and important, and this is why G. Ernest Wright felt archaeology was so important, because archaeology gives us a handle on that ancient history. The reason I mention that is because when you look at the literature, function versus history, G. Ernest Wright would probably come out on a different side than would John Walton. The idea that the ancient Hebrews would talk about function and exclude that or separate it from history would be, for G. Ernest Wright, probably an impossibility. And you can probably guess where I might come out in that question, but that's just for fodder for later on's discussion. After several years, through the 40s, 50s, and 60s, a new school of thought started to arise. It actually was challenging the skepticism of historical criticism, the traditional textual analysis of the Old Testament text. This was called minimalism, and one of the first shots was fired by this gentleman, John Van Cedars, who wrote a book in 1974 entitled Abraham and History and Tradition. And in this, he reintroduced, because historical criticism, I should say, was starting to struggle under the attacks of the Albrightian school. Every time they would come up with a textual argument, the archaeologists just laugh them off and say, you biblical scholars don't know the real world of the Bible. You have to be an archaeologist or a Near Eastern scholar to understand. And so this made, of course, the biblical scholars very upset, and it led to a lot of fighting going back and forth. Well, Van Cedars was more of a textual scholar, and he started to push the skepticism in a new direction. We call it minimalism today. And he reintroduced the charges that there's very little historical accuracy in the Bible. Some of the examples he used was references to camels in the Old Testament. Abraham is said to have had camels. And John Van Cedars said that's an impossibility. Camels were not domesticated early on. Ironically, Albright kind of agreed with him. He said, well, it's true, camels probably weren't domesticated till the time of King David. So the references to Abraham's camels is probably an anachronism, and the Old Testament might be wrong there. So Albright conceded that point. Van Cedars also argued that references to tents in the patriarchal period were clearly an anachronism. There were no tent living Bedouin living around the time of Abraham in the Middle East or in the ancient Near East. So these were some of the examples that he proposed to suggest that Abraham is not really historical. It made a major impact on the historicity of the patriarchal narratives. When my professor Bill Deaver started out in his career with G. Ernest Wright at Harvard in the 60s, he believed in Abraham. After the 70s and the attack of minimalism, you can follow my professor's thinking, and Abraham goes out the door. Okay, there is no Abraham anymore. There is no real patriarchal period. I have a few articles of Professor Deaver where he defends it. Later on, he jettisons it. But there still was a Joshua and a Moses and the walls of Jericho, right? Okay, so they hung on to that. That's where history would start, would be at the time of the Exodus. Meanwhile, Tom Thompson, whose wife actually was a member of our excavation team, so I knew Dorothy. They didn't get along very well and split up. He was sort of an ornery guy, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, maybe that made him very skeptical about all things, including the Bible. He was an American who went to Scandinavia and became part of what's called the Scandinavian School, and he also wrote a book in 1974 on the patriarchal period, also arguing that there is no history in the first part of the Old Testament. And so he helped, along with Van Cedars, push the minimalist movement. And then from the University of Copenhagen, this is just like about four out of, a few dozen minimalists that were pushing these ideas through the 70s and 80s and 90s. Niels Lemke, he argued that all the material in the Old Testament was probably very late, not just the patriarchal period. He denied that there is much historicity in the biblical text at all. I've had the privilege of meeting him. When I once suggested that there might be something in the Iron Age that's historical, he got up and challenged me in a meeting. So we've had our own encounters with Professor Lemke. He's very, very skeptical. And then we have another American, I think he's American, who maybe from England, who has challenged the historicity of the monarchy. So eventually, you see, Abraham went, then Moses went, and Joshua and the walls of Jericho. These were all things that were debated. Minimalists concluded there's no historical veracity to any of these claims. And Davies pushed it even into the monarchy and said there's not even any historically reliable evidence, no archaeological evidence for suggesting there was a King Solomon or a King David, or switch around David and Solomon. And when the Dan inscription, which I'll mention in a few minutes, was discovered, he actually suggested the Dan inscription was a stone that was found in northern Israel at the site of Dan, and it has the name Beit David on it, the house of David. And Davies was actually the one who published an article in Biblical Archaeologist suggesting that the stone was a fraud. It was a plant, the inscription was a fake, which made the excavators very angry, and that led to some very interesting back and forth, too. Davies wrote an article analyzing the inscription, but he was ripped to shreds by archaeologists and paleographers who said Davies didn't know what he was talking about and should stick to textual analysis if he even knew how to do that. They were not very pleasant, and Davies fought right back. The articles are extremely entertaining if you like provocative stuff. Read Biblical Archaeologists. It's been renamed Near Eastern Archaeology. That's in itself an interesting story, the Biblical Archaeology Review tells a lot of those stories going on. Most of the minimalists were textual scholars, and they did not generate a lot of support among archaeologists. Ironically, you may be interested in knowing, most archaeologists I know tend to be more on the conservative end of the spectrum. That doesn't mean they're evangelical, infallible scripture kind of people, but they tend to look at the biblical story and say, yeah, the archaeological record seems to support most of the stories at some level that are found in the Bible. One of the few archaeologists to go against that trend is this gentleman, Israel Finkelstein, who teaches at Tel Aviv University in Israel. He's sometimes said to be the godfather of the Tel Aviv Mafia. I've had fun interacting with him. He and my major professor have had some real big battles in the journals over the last 20 years. He added credibility to the minimalist claim by saying that the monarchy probably didn't exist, at least it was not nearly as great as the Bible says it was, and he tried to redate a lot of archaeological cities and strata that had been excavated, saying these never belonged to David and Solomon at all, the archaeologists are wrong, and really the evidence for David and Solomon does not really exist. That made the archaeology community very angry at Finkelstein, particularly my professor, William Deaver. The reason for that, bringing Bill back into it, is that he had made his name digging at Gezer in the 1960s, before the minimalist debate became big. And while digging at Gezer, while he himself had skepticism about the Bible and embraced a pretty liberal view of historical criticism, Deaver actually felt that he had found evidence for King Solomon's palace and gateway at Gezer. It's actually mentioned in the Bible in 1 Kings 9, and he said, I have found evidence of Solomon. That's one of the few things in the Bible that's still true. Deaver had by this time given up on Abraham. He had given up on Moses. He'd given up on Joshua and Jericho, but he was still clinging to David and Solomon, and he had actually found levels in the ground that seemed to support the biblical story of Solomon rebuilding the city of Gezer along with Jericho, Megiddo, and Hazor. And so this got Deaver mad. In fact, Finkelstein, in a famous exchange, called Bill Deaver nothing more than a closet fundamentalist. And that made Deaver very angry. He's actually been pretty much on the liberal side of things in terms of these debates. And so that got his blood up, and he went right after Finkelstein, and the debate hasn't subsided. And this just talks about some of this. What an interesting thing, this is where I entered into the picture. Back in the 1980s, I was a student of Bill Deaver at the University of Arizona. And when the first shots of this fight started going back and forth, Finkelstein challenged Deaver's stratigraphy at Gezer. I have a picture of Gezer coming up here. There's Gezer right there. That was a picture of the excavation during the 60s when Deaver was in charge after Ernest Wright started the dig. He turned it over to his doctoral student, Deaver, who ran this dig for several seasons. I would come and join Deaver there at the same site in the 1990 season, so that's already 21 years ago. But anyway, Deaver had dug here, but when Finkelstein challenged some of his work, Bill whispered to me, he said, you know, there is a little problem. When I dug up the Solomonic remains, I didn't dig deep enough to make sure I had a good date on them. I found what I thought was right, and I stopped, and I proclaimed that I had Solomon at Gezer, that I found a palace and a gate fortification dating to the time of Solomon. And the Bible says that Solomon rebuilt Gezer, and these would be the kinds of things that Solomon would have been expected to build. But Deaver told me, he said, you know, I never did get to the bottom. Somebody should go back and dig at Gezer again. And this was in 1980, the conversation took place in 1989. The fight was going on in the literature between 85 and 89 between Finkelstein and Deaver. And so I, of course, wanted to dig with Deaver. He told me he was retired from field work, but there's a number of his late doctoral students were saying, we'd like to go with you. Just go one more time. He said, I'm getting too old for that. And we kind of would bug him. But when this article came out calling him a closet fundamentalist, he was so angry. And he confided to me, we really should go back and dig some more. And I said, well, what if I'm a teacher at Andrews University? What if we got some money together? And we go out and let's do another season and dig under the Palace of Solomon, under the gateway and so forth. And he said, well, that costs quite a bit of money. And I said, well, how much would it take to mount a field season? He says, well, for about 8 weeks or so, it cost $40,000, which was a good deal in those days. It doesn't cost that anymore. It'd be well over $100,000 now. But he said, we'd need to raise $40,000. And I said, boy, it sure would be great if we could go. I know all the students, including myself, would love to go out with you in the field. And Deaver said to me, he said, I'll tell you what, if you can raise $20,000, I'll get the other $20,000. And he was thinking I would never get it. So I was working, you can remember perhaps who the dean was at the time here at the seminary. I called up my boss at the seminary and said, hey, we've got a great chance. Andrews University can partner with the University of Arizona and excavate this site of Gezer, which is a really hot topic in the archaeological literature now, but we need some money. And the dean at that time asked me, well, how much money do you need? And I said, we need $20,000. And I was expecting him to fall over, but there was silence on the other end of the line for a moment. He says, let me make a couple phone calls, I'll call you back. So I hung up, and about 15 minutes later, the dean called me and he said, I've got $20,000 for you. So I call my professor Deaver. This was the same day that he, you know, was not. And I said, I've got my $20,000, where's yours? And he was quite taken aback by that. And he said, really? I said, yes, I've got $20,000. He said, well, let me make some phone calls. He had some friends at National Geographic. He made a phone call there, and he was able to come up with his $20,000, and suddenly we had our $40,000, and off we went. And that's in itself a whole lecture I give, but I don't have time today, so I'm just kind of pointing you out to this. So we arrived in 1990 to re-excavate the Solomonic Gateway and the palace, plus we were doing a wall that was dated supposedly to the time of Joshua. So I was appointed as Bill's assistant director. That was my first administrative responsibility with him. I'd done some digging, of course, in Jordan before this time. And so I was a co-director with my professor. And that dig generated an awful lot of interest. People from all over the country of Israel, leading archaeologists came to see. There's a younger me down in a pit looking at a key piece of stratigraphic evidence that we have excavated. Deaver's in the khaki up to the left there. So we had lots of people coming all through the summer. Trudy Dutton is on the left of this photograph in the white top, and then the light blue shirt, that's Cy Gittin, who's the director of the Jerusalem Albright Center, named after William Albright. Amahai Mazar is in the blue jeans, and Bill Deaver's the right, and I'm standing in the foreground listening to the great debate. Most of these guys were on our side. They thought Finkelstein was wrong, but they were very keenly interested in the stratigraphic excavation. Finkelstein in the beard and the Gulligan hat cap to the right there, he's the godfather of the Tel Aviv Mafia and a very staunch minimalist. He came to visit us, of course, at the dig, and he was expecting us to have shown that there was no evidence for Solomon or Joshua and so forth. And Deaver's a bit of a ham, in a way. We had actually found the evidence, but Deaver wouldn't tell him when he showed up. All these students in the background are Finkelstein students, and Deaver took him to a number of our probes. We did a number of excavation probes. It's too technical, I won't go into that, but we were able to get underneath the structures and find evidence for Solomon's palace and gate dating to the 10th century, and that seemed to comport well with some biblical and Egyptian evidence. Again, that's another story. But here's Deaver putting his hand on his chest. I had my camera ready, and he was showing Finkelstein on the right some of our early probes, and they seemed to support Finkelstein's conclusions, this minimalist skeptical view, and Finkelstein is smiling very big. And then after he takes him to all the failed probes, he takes him to the one where we had the deepest penetration. We actually found the early material we were looking for. And Deaver jumped like a little child into the pit and is pointing at the side of the excavation square. And you can see the perplexed Finkelstein off to the left. He was not pleased by the results that we claimed we were finding that summer. And this led to further exchanges. And of course, Andrews had the joy of being right in the middle of this. Amahaimazar and Amon Bentor were on our side and against Finkelstein, two other Israeli archaeologists, and it became a very heated debate going back and forth. I'll leave out some of the details. While this was going on, a meeting was held in Chicago that I attended. This is in the late 80s, early 90s, I forget the exact year. But the meeting in Chicago dealt with the question, was there a King Solomon, was there a King David? I went to about six or eight papers at this, read by a number of different scholars. The conclusion was that David was no more historical than Arthur, King Arthur, and the Knights of the Round Table. One scholar even said, David is no more historical than Jack and the Beanstalk. Okay, that was actually said there. So this was the general consensus of the view of the minimalist session that we attended in Chicago. Right after that meeting, Abraham Bayron, an Israeli archaeologist, was digging at Tel Dan in the northern part of Israel, right up against the border with Lebanon, and one of his graduate student volunteers, not his student, but a student from another university, found a stone in the gateway in the background of this picture. When she pulled this stone out, it was unusually flat, and she was suspicious there might be writing on it, and sure enough, when she pulled the stone out of the wall, turned it around, there was ancient writing on it. The writing was in Aramaic, which is related to Hebrew. They found at least three pieces of the stone, and as they started deciphering it, they realized that this was a victory stela by a Syrian king in Damascus who had conquered the Israelites, the northern kingdom of Israel, in the 9th century B.C. And in the course of bragging about his conquest of the Israelites, he talks about his defeat of the Beit David, the house of David. And you can see it in the lower right-hand picture in the white chalk. Those are the letters there. This made the minimalists very angry because they had just proclaimed David dead and gone and not a historical figure. And that led to Phil Davies, who I showed you the picture of earlier, claiming that this was a fraud, that this had actually been concocted by Bayron or one of his staff and was not an authentic inscription. All the experts who had looked at it claimed that it was, that the letters and so forth were shaped genuinely in antiquity. The context seemed to prove that it was an ancient stone in situ. And what was more embarrassing was that the young lady graduate student who pulled it out of the wall, thinking it might be inscription, turned out to be a student of one of the minimalist professors. She did not want to find this inscription. And yet she found it, and she had to admit that, no, it was found in situ, and I took it out myself. And so that shot down the fraudulent argument. Most scholars I know believe that this is indeed a reference to the David. There was an interesting exchange where the minimalists tried to reinterpret Beit David. You don't have vowels in Hebrew or Aramaic, so you have the name for David is just DVD. Not like we have today for computers and watching movies, but you don't have the A and the I for David or David. You just have the three letters. And of course, the V can be sometimes in Hebrew or Aramaic used as an O or a U. And so the minimalist said, this isn't David, this is the house of the dude. Okay, not David, but dude, or the house of Dode. And those may seem a little bit silly, but they mean things like uncle or beloved or kettle or something like that. Or someone even suggested maybe there's an ancient god called Dude or Dode, you know, and this is the house of this god. The problem with all these attempts were that they didn't really fit into the corpus of ancient Near Eastern literature, and none of the experts would buy into this. They said, you've got to get over it. They found David. This is indeed a reference to the house of David. Nothing else makes historical or grammatical sense. So they continued on with a number of excavations. I need to come to a close here. This just gives you one of the battles. Deaver, of course, fought back in a number of articles about the rise of the Israelite monarchy. And I'll kind of skip over some of this. He had an interesting exchange. This is another friend of mine, Max Miller. He's more of a minimalist. He taught for years biblical archaeology and history at Emory University. And he and Deaver mixed it up. Miller tends to place more emphasis on the biblical text. Miller claimed that artifacts don't talk, that the biblical text has historical critical scholars reconstruct it is superior to archaeology. That made the archaeologists, including Deaver, very angry. Deaver replied in an article that textual scholars just don't know how to listen. Okay, so Miller said that the text speaks and the artifacts don't. Deaver said the artifacts speak, that you're just too deaf to hear them. So, and there is a lot of sophisticated analysis we do with artifacts that would take, you know, we can tell whether sometimes a male or a female made a pot. We can tell based on the pottery whether it was a patriarchal or a matriarchal society. These are technical things that would take a long time to explain. We can tell what they had for dinner sometimes even based on analysis of residue in the pots and so forth. We can talk about trade relationships. We can talk about economics. We can find out an awful lot about the background of the people that made the pots. And that's just one area in which archaeologists have learned to listen to the artifacts carefully. And so Deaver did not respect Miller's accusations there. And so they continued, and debates have been going on for now over 100 years about the role of the artifacts versus the text. I know Miller quite well. You might be interested in some of his criticisms here. He said at first scholars had high hopes of finding inscriptions, epigraphical sources, such as the Merneptah Stela found in 1896 that actually mentions the name of Israel, and the Egyptians fought a people called Israel. By the way, one of our own Adventists, Mike Hosel from Southern Hat, wrote his PhD dissertation on this topic and has gotten a lot of mileage and respect out of dealing with the issue of Merneptah Stela. It's a very controversial issue. He does talk about the Tel Dan inscription, but Miller's conclusion was, yet when all is taken into account, the epigraphical evidence pertaining to ancient Israel is meager and disappointing. Miller was hoping we'd find more inscriptions, and the fact is that of all the countries in the Middle East, when you dig in Mesopotamia or Iraq, you dig in Egypt, and then you come to Israel or Palestine, we find lots of inscriptions from Mesopotamia and Egypt, very few from Israel. It has been a big disappointment. The reasons may be that the climate is not conducive to preserving papyrus and so forth in Israel. There's too much rain and so forth. So we are having problems. It may just be a question of luck. Amnon Ben-Tor, who digs at Hatzor, a famous biblical site near Galilee, has actually found a half a dozen clay tablets, and he believes Hatzor, of course, was a Solomonic city and goes back to the time of Joshua. He believes he's close to finding an Israelite archive. He keeps finding bits of the tablet, but he's been digging for 20 years and hasn't found the archive itself. And a lot of times it's just plain luck. You can dig and dig and dig, and you don't always find something. You can just miss it by a few feet. That's the problem with working in archaeology. I should also add, you might be interested in this, guess how much after over 100 years of scientific archaeological excavation in the ancient Near East, that would include Mesopotamia, Egypt, Jordan, Israel, Lebanon, and Syria, how much has been exposed after over 100 years of scientific excavation? You'd say very little. That would be correct. One archaeologist actually did a calculation, Edmund Yamaukchi. He said that of all the sites that had been dug in over 100 years, we've only uncovered 0.1% of what's buried. So you can see that when you make a pronouncement about, well, they haven't found this, it's dangerous. As Deaver said, you know, all it takes is one more shovel and your elegant theory will be destroyed by the ugly fact. And the ugly facts are coming up every season. So Miller is sort of a pessimistic view. He says, we haven't found the documents. We can't really prove Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses. We have not found their names. We think we have David, though, now, so we have to scratch this one off the list. He says, it's not until the 9th century, and Miller's correct about this, the time of Ahab and Jezebel, did we start finding lots of epigraphical or written evidence. But we are finding a lot. We've even found a few inscriptions now at Jalul that are slowly being published. And this is just one of these brag shots of me with Miller. We're good friends, even though we are diametrically opposed on the Bible. We can talk to each other, and that's kind of nice. I've been down to his university to lecture, and he's been up here and lectured at Andrews University a few years ago. So he has sort of a half-empty view of what archaeology does for the Bible. But then there's Kenneth Kitchen, Egyptologist from Liverpool, a world-renowned Egyptologist, an expert on the Ramesside period. He argues that the glass of archaeology and the Bible is half full. And he says, if you really go through the evidence, and he wrote a book published just about 5 years ago entitled On the Reliability of the Old Testament, Hitchin points out that really when you look at the big picture, the Bible is more accurate than not. He says, for example, and this is a very thick book, so I'm just giving you a couple of quickies here as we close. Out of 20 foreign rulers and a general mentioned in the Bible, all but two have turned up in external records, or three. He said 17 out of 20, usually in their home turf. So most of the people that were attacking Israel, they really existed, and we have found evidence of them. Of the three that don't, they come from periods when the local records in Mesopotamia and Egypt are still missing. And then when you look at foreign kings mentioned in foreign records, beginning with Omri and Ahab, 9 out of 14 Hebrew kings have been found in archaeological sources. They were real people who are mentioned by their enemies, the Assyrians and the Babylonians. Then Hebrew kings in local records. Every year we keep finding seals. We have found the names on seals and inscriptions of Joram and Ahaziah and Uzziah and Jeroboam and Hoshea and Ahaz and Hezekiah. All are known from inscriptions that have been found in the ground. Moreover, Kitchen points out that the sequence of rulers, when you look at how they're mentioned and the sequence in which they're ruling in the Bible, and you compare that with the archaeological inscriptions, we're finding they live in the right time periods. So whoever wrote the Old Testament seemed to know when these guys lived and where they were living and seemed to have a pretty good, accurate overview of Old Testament history. At least 10 different specific historical events are known in both Hebrew and extra-biblical sources, such as the Battle of Lachish. It's mentioned in the Book of Kings, and we've actually dug Lachish, and we find a lot of correlations, and also Assyrian records of the Battle of Lachish from their side of the battle. Also the Mesha inscription found near our site of Jalul, that is written by the Moabite king Mesha, and he talks about Omri and Ahab, and we have the biblical account of their battle with Mesha. So we have a number of these historical tie-ins. So by and large, the ancients did not invent spurious history. Really, they were content to interpret real history in accord with their views. The basic presentation of almost 350 years of the story of the Hebrew twin kingdoms comes out to be factually reliable in almost all points. We do have some issues with the early biblical periods, though. James Hoffmeyer, and I am coming to a close here, has published a couple of books dealing with Israel and Egypt, entitled The Evidence for the Authenticity of the Exodus Tradition, and it's received very good reviews, that it's not unreasonable to believe that there was a Moses, there was an Israelite nation that left Egypt and settled in the Promised Land. So that another important word. Then just in closing, a couple other recent discoveries you might be interested in. Professor Meyer in the upper left-hand corner found an inscription at Tel Asafi, which many archaeologists believe might be biblical Gath of the famous Philistine connection. And they found the name Goliath, the family name Goliath, actually dating to the right time period on an ostracon there. And this was something that the minimalists did not expect to find and did not want to find. But it may be that there's something to the story of David and Goliath. We have both of them. And then critics have also said Moses and others could not have written the Bible because they didn't know how to write. They recently found a 10th century alphabet in Hebrew at Tel Zayit, which is near Tel Asafi. And Ron Tapper there in the lower right-hand picture was here at Andrews presenting his evidence. So this keeps the discussion going. In closing, there was a meeting just a few years ago in response to the minimalists. It was organized by Jim Hoffmeyer, who wrote that book on the Exodus. And he invited Christians, Jews, and atheists, anyone who thought that there might be something historically reliable in the Bible, and we all give papers on why we thought the Bible ought to be given a fair shot at being historically viable. Adventists were also invited to present papers, including David Merling, Larry Garrity, and myself. In response, this is a little bit of self-bragging here. Richard Halota, a Jewish scholar, did a critique of this book from a scholarly perspective for the Bulletin of the American Schools of Oriental Research, and she was favorably impressed with what's called the Andrews University way of doing archaeology. What had happened was I wrote a history of Adventists and archaeology for this session. They were curious about how do people of faith relate to this whole issue. And so I described the history of Adventist archaeology, and I described the way that we do archaeology, and it really impressed both Rachel, there were lights. I guess somebody probably leaned against the back, maybe not. Maybe the light just got tired. We're coming to a close here. Anyway, Eric Klein picked up on what I wrote about how Adventists do scholarship, and he wrote a book for the National Geographic called From Eden to Exile. And he talks about Adventist methodology. He was talking about goofball archaeology, like Ron Wyatt and the discovery of Noah's Ark and the Ark of the Covenant and all these other kinds of spurious claims. And he said, really, he said, if you would look at how Adventists do scholarship, here are people has a group of scholars that believe in the Bible. They take the Bible seriously, and yet they also do good scientific work. He said, everybody, whether you believe in God or not, could take a lesson from the evidence. If we all followed this scientific methodology, we would all be okay, and we would not come out with these goofball, spurious claims that you see in archaeology from time to time. What we had written in the book, in this book that grabbed the attention, was a summary of the tradition that started with Siegfried Horn and that we try and emulate today as Seventh-day Adventists. Be forthright with your findings. Do not minimize problems or stretch interpretations of data to explain things away. That's often a temptation when you find something. A lot of biblical archaeologists say they want to believe in the Bible, and I do believe in the Bible. If you know me, you know that I do. But you don't stretch your data to fit the interpretation. That ends up shedding doubt upon the credibility of your work when you stretch the interpretation. Secondly, do not make claims beyond what the data can support. Third, be quick and complete in publishing results. Get them out there for the world of scholarship to analyze. Fourth, engage in work within mainstream scholarship. We as Adventists do not need to be embarrassed to work with the real world of scholarship. And I think our work in archaeology has established or shown how that can work. Five, include a diversity of people and specialists. Of course, archaeology is great at that. We bring in linguists, historians, art historians, geologists, biologists, all sorts of different disciplines, because archaeology is the ultimate multidisciplinary discipline. And finally, and this is the one I thought I'd get jumped on, take the history of the Bible seriously. That was kind of a brave thing to say, but do not place upon archaeology the burden of proving the Bible. For me, the Bible is true regardless of what archaeology says or doesn't say. That's from my faith position, and I could elaborate on that. Ironically, my colleague Eric Klein, who's a humanist Jew, that's how he describes himself, agrees with my position. And he said, I have no problem with that. He says, we should all take the history of the Bible seriously. He was looking, I think, a little bit negatively at the minimalist, hyper-skeptical view and acknowledge that the archaeology was too rich to just write the entire Bible off. As a result of that book and this conference, the National Geographic picked up on my critique of archaeology, and they invited both me and Eric Klein to be consultants for a book that was just published last year called Letter and Scroll, What Archaeology Tells Us About the Bible. I was actually invited to come to the National Geographic headquarters in Washington, D.C. I was on the platform with a couple of atheists, my colleague Eric Klein, who's the humanist Jew, and I was invited with one other Christian from another faith, and we all had a rousing debate on the platform in front of the audience at National Geographic on how to relate science and faith as we try and pursue the discipline of archaeology. It was a lot of fun, and as a result of that, we were able to put this book together. National Geographic came to me and they said, what should go in a book on biblical archaeology? And they went to Eric Klein and said, what would you put in this book? So we each wrote our list down, and I think I won. And Eric worked with me, and we ended up giving them the topics. And they hired two professional writers for National Geographic who were not archaeologists. They wrote the whole thing up, and then they ran it all by us after it was written and made sure that it was scientifically and sound from a scholarly perspective. Then they published it. And that was a fun job because they actually paid us for it. And only National Geographic can do a good thing like that. So, and then we've had some exposure to some other books. This was a major book on the archaeology. Jordan Adventists have been very prominent in that, and I was privileged to edit this with a number of other colleagues. All of the work that Americans have done in the country of Jordan, and just this year we published a book that had many articles by non-Adventist scholars talking about the Adventist way of doing archaeology, the Multiple Plains Project after 40 years, just published a few months ago. So what have Adventists found that helps our understanding of the Bible? We have found insights into the kingdom of Sion and the conquest, thanks to Dr. Horn and Garrity and so forth. We discovered much about the biblical Ammonites. In fact, that area we work in is called Seventh-day Ammonite Land because of all the Adventists working there. We've discovered a historical person, Baalis, the Ammonite king, that's mentioned in the book of Isaiah. We believe we discovered the pools of Heshbon, but that's another story. We've discovered evidence for Solomon's activities at Gezer, and a discovery that I made a few years ago and that I've published, we have found evidence for camels in the patriarchal period. I found a petroglyph in the Sinai area north of the traditional Mount Sinai that shows a man leading a camel next to an Egyptian inscription that dates to the patriarchal period. And so that tends to overthrow another one of the minimalist claims. We've gotten some mileage out of that as well. And that's just a little bit of some of the insights that we've offered. Why do we do archaeology? Well, I think Christians should pursue excellence in scholarship because God expects us to do our best. I do think it's important to uphold the integrity of the Word of God. We can argue about what that means, but I think we would agree on that basic conclusion. It helps us preach the good news more effectively and helps us win souls for God's kingdom. Thank you very much.
Testing, yeah, okay. Questions? Can you elaborate for me a little bit of the artifact text debate, just a tad more? What are the dynamics of that debate?
It's pretty simple, really. People like Max Miller would say there are a couple levels of interpretation when you find that pot. When you find that rock, you know, you're having to do some extrapolation, and it's not as cognitive as a text is. And so Max Miller would say the Bible text, we have all this material, you're going to get more understanding about the ancient Israelites by reading the biblical text. Now, Deaver argues, look, you historical critics are telling us that this is a redacted text, that it was ripped apart, put together through so many centuries. And Deaver would say, it's such a redacted and messed up text, it's a curated artifact, according to you biblical scholars, why should I pay any attention to it? It's so far removed from the historical times it's supposed to be talking about that archaeology is contemporary, the text is not. So I would give priority to the archaeological record over the text. Now, obviously, I don't agree with that division completely myself. I don't completely accept the historical critical, reconstruction of the text. I am more conservative of the text, and I think there's reasons to think that the text is older and reflects accurately what was going on back there. So I'm in a different ground. But that's the basic argument, is does the text have priority for reconstructing Israel's ancient history, or does the archaeological record have priority? Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. And you can tell that people haven't quite decided. There's not a consensus on that question.
You're talking about David and
their interpretation of the script, and you mentioned that they translated as dude or Daud.
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 Yeah.
I'm just wondering if they're aware, you may know this and it's not germane to it, but that in Farsi, which and Arabic, Daud translates to David
sure.
in English.
Sure, yeah. They are aware of that. What they're trying to do is come up with a word other than David. In Hebrew, it would be DVD, normally David. They're not saying Daud, they're saying dude or Daud, not Daud, which would be a slightly different word. So you're correct about that. Daud would be a way of saying, and in Arabic, too, modern Arabic, Daud is David. But they weren't going that way. They were trying to say that this was a totally different word, that it's maybe the temple of a dude or a dod, temple of the uncle, temple of the, one of the other possible translations is kettle, temple of the pot or the kettle. But none of those things is A, in common usage, and B, it doesn't make much sense in the context. And this is a victory stela by a king. The logical person he'd be bragging about is the conquest of the enemy king that he just took land away from him. So that's the more logical interpretation. And the form, Beit David, is similar to a couple of its occurrences in the Hebrew Bible text. So looking at it all together, most scholars think we really have found extra biblical evidence for David. Since this came out, there's been two more inscriptions that have been claimed to mention David. One is the Mesha inscription itself, which has been known since 1867. But what people don't remember is that when that stone was found and before it was destroyed, an impression was made of it. And then the stone was destroyed, and they tried to do their best to reconstruct it. But there's some sections missing in the stone as it is today in the Louvre. But a French scholar, André Lemaire, went back to the old, the storehouse. I was just in the Louvre myself doing some work earlier this year. But anyway, André Lemaire went back, and he looked in the original squeeze from the 1860s and found the name David in one of the missing sections. And so that's a second piece of evidence. And then Kenneth Kitchen himself claims that Karnak, there's a reference to the heights of David, has a place that one of the Egyptian kings conquered near Jerusalem. So we now have three possible references to King David in archaeological extra-biblical literature.
In this week's Sabbath School lesson, we read, among many other things, that the Ark of the Covenant will be found before the end of time. What are the minimalists going to say when that happens?
well, they probably won't like it. And
can they date it to Moses or to the time of the Exodus?
If an archaeological artifact like that were found in an archaeological context and it was shown not to be a fake, it would be, you know, an amazing discovery. There's no doubt about it. It would, of course, depending on exactly what it looks like and what we find, it would rewrite the entire discipline of biblical archaeology and Old Testament history. A lot of speculation about that. Of course, minimalists would say no such artifact existed and will never be found. But if it would be found, it would be, you know, an amazing thing. The claims that it has been found, none of those to date have been borne out by investigation. There's a lot of claims that it's been, you know, found here and there, but it does not, it has not been found yet.
Even in Hollywood movies.
Even in Hollywood movies. If it has been found, it's in a warehouse somewhere, like in the basement of the Horn Museum. We joke about that, but it hasn't really been found.
Enters into this debate also the comparison between biblical text and text, for instance, from Egypt, the wisdom text, which are often referred to as that Solomon was, you know, taking from that source or that source, that they came both from the same source.
Yeah, there's no doubt there's the Osiris stele, which I saw in the Louvre just a few weeks ago also. And when you read it, it reads very much like one of the Psalms in the way it praises God and so forth. You know, even the wording and some of the descriptions about how wonderful and glorious and loving God is and just and fair sounds almost identical. So there's no doubt that there were genre similarities between what the Hebrews were doing as they would praise God and what their neighbors were doing, both in Egypt and Mesopotamia. So you could look at that too. Way. Some people would say, the Hebrews were copying. That's a little difficult, though, to establish because there's also significant differences. Clearly, the Hebrews had their own theological take, but there does seem to have been a common understanding about the proper way to praise God, and we see that reflected in the Egyptian culture as well as the Assyrian and Babylonian cultures as well as in the Hebrew culture. So there may have been a general understanding of the right way to relate to God that was transcultural. And some of these texts are so close. It also helps, ironically, give an early date for some of these proverbs because we can date the Egyptian parallels, and we do see the evolution of these genres through time. And some of the Hebrew material seems to reflect the earlier literary works of these sister cultures. Even the Genesis account, in my opinion, there's more parallels with the Atrahasis epic than there is with the Eridu-Genesis. Many people compare the Babylonian Eridu-Genesis with, you know, Genesis 1, 2, and 3. I think a better comparison is with the, Enuma Elish. That's later, and the Gilgamesh epic, that's later. But Genesis, when you look at it carefully and critically, has more in common with the Atrahasis epic and the Eridu-Genesis, which are Akkadian and Sumerian, and they date much, much earlier. So that, to me, is another argument why the Genesis account is an early creation story, not a late one that the Israelites copied while they were in the exile from the Babylonians. That just doesn't wash with me. And more literary scholars are coming to that same conclusion. Yeah.
Okay. You have a question?
Yeah, I really appreciated your discussion of the, quote, Adventist way in archaeology.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's something not me personally, can be proud of.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that you've been able to do credible, peer-reviewed science, if you will, at the same time maintaining your faith stance and, you know, presenting the data for what it's worth, taking it at face value.
Yeah.
I guess the inevitable question came to me, what would happen if Adventist biologists and geologists took that same approach? Should they? Do they? Would they survive?
I think it's a good approach, and I think it could be used profitably by all Adventist scholars in any discipline. And to be honest, a couple of my colleagues, particularly physicists, have grabbed onto this, and they're trying to promote it within the ranks of some of our Adventist physicists. Yeah. And I don't have a problem with it. You know, we all have our challenges. We all have the issues we have to deal with. I tend to be comfortable with the Bible pretty much as it reads, but I'm not unaware of the problems and the challenges. You can't help but be when you're working in a scientific discipline. And as I reflected on it, and I looked at the history of how Adventists work, I try to summarize from the time of Siegfried to what we do today, what we do. My faith position's a little more conservative than some of my colleagues. I won't mention them by name, but I work with some very fine archaeologists. When it comes to the biblical text, there's some things we flat out disagree with. But we do agree on the principles of how to do good science, and we also recognize that, and this is particularly important for me, as a believer, I only hurt my case or my cause when I overstate the data, and too many people prior to my time have done that. They've tried to twist the data to make it support the Bible, and while the motivation may be understandable, they end up undermining their credibility, and that's the worst thing I think we can do as practicing scientists. So a lot of things, when I have problem, I have to put them on the intellectual shelf, so to speak. I still believe in them because of my faith in God. But I'm not afraid to say there's some things I don't understand and some problems that I don't have answers for.
Thanks. Okay, any other questions? All right. You've heard that you have an extra yacht or two. Archaeology is getting more expensive.
Absolutely.
So later next week, we can see if maybe we can sell that yacht. Pass the hat, and archaeology can benefit.
We do have an excavation going this May for 3 weeks and also next summer. So if any of you, there's about three or four of you that have been in our dig. So I would also invite you, if you're interested, would like to get your hands in the dirt and help us dig up the golden foot of Solomon or something in the statue, come along and put shovel to ground.
Let's thank Dr. Yonker.
Thank you.